This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, the adventures one might have rowing one's way around the eastern U.S. Nathaniel Stone put a boat into the East River in April 1999. By August of 2000, he had rowed the Hudson and a stretch of Lake Erie. He had rowed into the Ohio River, down the Mississippi, out into the Gulf of Mexico, and back up along the Atlantic seaboard. He's written a book about the trip, On the Water, Discovering America in a Rowboat, is published by Broadway Books. Nathaniel Stone is our guest this afternoon. We'll talk with him about what led him to make such a voyage. We'll also talk about the places he visited and the people he met. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for Nathaniel Stone. Join the discussion with a telephone call. Our number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you're outside the Champaign-Urbana area and it would be a long-distance call, call us toll-free. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Nathaniel Stone grew up in Marblehead, Massachusetts. Today, he makes his home in Zuni, New Mexico, where he founded the local newspaper and has taught high school history. Listeners, we look forward to your calls. Again, the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Nathaniel Stone, good afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Sure. I'm going to start with the question you say so many people have asked you. I think it is a question that contains amazement and admiration. What possessed you?
It's funny. While rowing and then later while writing the book, I often ask myself the question, where does anything begin? Where does a trip begin? Where does a rowing trip begin? And in some ways, I can trace this trip back to before my earliest memories, to sort of my earliest sense of myself, and before that, to the fact that my father was a rower in college, well before I was born. But I can trace it more concretely to a fascination that I had as a child with boats and a fascination that I had with travel. And at some point when I was 8 or 9 or 10 years old, somewhere in there, in just sort of flipping through the family atlas, taking sort of imaginary trips, I asked myself the question whether it was possible, having seen the Mississippi River as a major waterway through the middle of the country, whether it's possible to take a boat entirely around the eastern United States, the question being, is the eastern United States an island? And after a little bit of searching, I discovered that the answer is yes, and so remained fascinated by this idea of the eastern U.S. as an island, which to me was my own sort of personal discovery.
Mm-hmm.
About 10 years later, more than a decade later, I read a biography of Howard Blackburn, who was a 19th century Gloucester fisherman in Massachusetts, who later in his life attempted to sail a boat around the exact same route. And so I was amazed and fascinated that this guy, whose life I just read about, had thought almost 100 years before me about this island route and had tried to circumnavigate himself. That was actually just around my graduation from college. In fact, I was diagnosed with chickenpox the day of my college graduation, and so I had nothing to do for a few weeks but read books, and this is one of the books I read. It took another 10 years before I finally decided that this was an idea that was not fading in my mind. A billion-dollar business idea might fade from your mind 2 weeks later. This trip was not fading. And I decided that if I was ever going to find out whether this was something within my range, I would have to drop everything and start rowing, and that's what happened.
That's what happened. As a kid, you mentioned you loved the water and boats, and you built your first boat when you were just 8. Would you describe that effort for us?
Oh, the very first boat was really, a coastal version of a Huck Finn trip. It was built out of a shipping pallet and some old pieces of plywood and immediately swamped itself. It was really no boat whatsoever, but it certainly captured the imagination. The next boat I built, which which I don't think is mentioned in the book, is a little skiff, just a very simple skiff that I built with my father at the age of 10, and which I used to haul lobster traps off the coast of Marblehead, northern Massachusetts.
Hmm. Well, here we are in central Illinois, and most of us are far from water, although we have listeners in Chicago who are close to Lake Michigan, and we have listeners who listen to us along the Illinois River and even the Ohio River. But a good number of us are far from navigable waterways. And I'm wondering, you know, what it's like to build a boat and to be able to do something like that yourself and then, under your own power, paddle around.
I remember a way of answering this. I remember the years of boyhood when I was fascinated by cars, and I got all the car magazines, and I knew every car's 0 to 60 time and top speed and this sort of thing. And to me, a car was a ticket to freedom. And sure enough, when I finally got my car, I started driving across the country. A boat is, in my mind, a ticket to much broader freedoms. First of all, there's the creation of the creative process of building the boat, even if it's someone else's design. And then what it leads you to is, you know, an array of possible adventures that is beyond anyone's anyone's reach within one lifetime. In a boat, every boat to me, as I wrote at one point in the book, is an adventure. Every boat suggests an adventure. And even in the smallest boat, one can travel through thousands of miles of waterways within the U.S. without even tasting salt water, without ever even seeing a coastal oceanic horizon. And so I think a boat and the process of building a boat and then certainly taking any boat out onto the water, there's really no limitation to where one can go in both a literal and I think ultimately in the best of worlds and ultimately in a figurative sense.
Hmm. Here's a sentence from the book you mentioned about, you know, each boat suggesting its own adventure. Every hull suggests its own adventure, and I can entertain myself for hours on end, given a boatyard full of cradled hulls to wander through. I wonder if there's anyone whose imagination hasn't been stirred by boats and the possibility of sailing down a river or around the world.
You would have to have a real phobia, I think, about water to not be captured by anything from, whether it's a jet ski or a cruise ship or a little sailing catboat to a canoe to a kayak. One of my favorite childhood books was Paddle to the Sea by Hauling C. Hauling, the story of a Canadian Indian boy up at the northern shore of, actually, headwaters of Lake Superior, who carves this little canoe with a little version of himself within it and sets it adrift, sets it on top of a snowbank. The snow melts, turns into a trickle, and carries the canoe into a creek that turns into a stream that leads to the lake, and it's a story of his journey, paddle to the sea's journey down to the mouth of the St. Lawrence River. There are lots and lots of stories about those who, for practical reasons, traveled down, especially the Ohio River, in the long process of westward expansion in American history, and others who have gone down it more recently for recreational purposes. It really, to me, is the world of greatest freedom in my mind. Anything that's on water, it could be a farm pond, it could be the Atlantic Ocean, or anything in between.
Hmm. To stop and think about how important waterways have been in our history, before there were roads and superhighways and the like, people traveled the rivers like they were roads. They took them from one place to another. There's a lot of history involved here in the stories you tell as well. And as a history teacher, it's got to be something, obviously, you're very much aware of. Was there any one moment when the history of a place really grabbed you? really touched you?
You know, I was struck, this is not so much about one place as maybe two places. I was struck in, it was Point of Lahash, Louisiana, which is on the Mississippi River. Really, it's below New Orleans. It's just a day's row from the actual mouth of the Mississippi River. And there I met the husband of a woman who ran the ferry back and forth across the river. It's the last place at which there's a ferry on the Mississippi River, Point of Lahash. And her husband, he spoke to me with an accent that was so like a Maine accent that I almost asked, are you from Maine? Although there was no evidence otherwise that he was from Maine. And so I held my tongue. I didn't ask him. And every so often I picked up a syllable or a word that was clearly in a southern Louisiana Cajun accent. And that's when I was struck by the connection between, the living connection, lasting connection between life in the bayous among the Cajuns and their previous home in the eastern Maine and especially the eastern provinces of Canada. And that's still in Louisiana, in south Louisiana, that accent still lasts.
Yeah, it's amazing to hear that music in both New Orleans and in Maine and New Brunswick.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It's a relief. It was a relief to me. not just that connection between accents, but it was a relief to me along the rivers, and it was mainly along the rivers, not nearly so much along the coastlines, to hear the accents of the accents that are lasting in this country, and in what seems to be increasingly a sort of culturally homogeneous society, in which you can go into McDonald's in Sacramento and a McDonald's in Brunswick, Maine, and unless you look out the windows, you'll have no idea what state you're in. And to hear, to go to places, in a way I could, if I'd had a mind to do it and had a way to do it, I could have, this was a story, this was a route about changes in accent, this gradual shifting from northern accents to rural accents to southern accents to Cajun accents. And then swinging back around Florida and back up the coast, all a story of changing accents. And I remember thinking to myself, this was actually down in South Louisiana, where I met a guy named John Fro, who had been a tugboat captain, listening to his accent, listening to him talk about the kind of the demise of Cajun French. And thinking, you know, if you listen to national, television, say, NBC News or ABC News, CBS News, Tom Brokaw, these guys, they all have pretty much the same accents. You would never know, unless you knew that Tom Brokaw was from, I forget, South Dakota or North Dakota, that he was from there because he has adopted a sort of standard accent. And I thought to myself, I'd love to have a national news broadcasting company that was willing to have someone like John Fro with his Cajun accent deliver the news on Monday nights, and on Tuesday nights, somebody from, rural West Virginia, and then on Wednesdays, it's so-and-so from Seattle, you know, just to kind of, keep in touch with the provincialism of this country.
Yeah. From Brooklyn to Cairo to Memphis to Miami, it's the Nathaniel Stone Network News. I'm wondering, in southern Illinois, not far from where I'm sitting, the accent changes and becomes much more southern, and I would suspect that along the Ohio River, people sound pretty similar to one another, and I would imagine that would carry right into Cairo, Illinois.
It does. I wish I were more of a linguist, or I don't know what the term would be for somebody who really studies accents. But I don't remember real distinctions, say, between South Indiana and South Illinois, and say even farther up in Ohio. But there still was, maybe to my ear, an imperceptible shifting, and then every so often I would realize that I was in a new territory that was represented in at least in part by a new accent.
Hmm. Nathaniel Stone is our guest this afternoon. He put a boat into the East River in April of 1999, and then a little more than a year later, he had by the end of August, or by August of 2000. When was it you wrapped up, Nathaniel?
Well, the trip, the original idea for the trip was from the Brooklyn Bridge to the Brooklyn Bridge, so point A to point A. And by the time I made it to the Gulf, I knew that this was evolving into, from a trip into a lifestyle, and that it would not be enough for me to get back to Brooklyn. So I made it back to the Brooklyn Bridge on June 29th, I think, of 2000, and then continued on up the coast of New England to Eastport, Maine, which I reached on August 17th of 2000.
Hmm. So he, by the end of this trip in Eastport, Maine, he'd rode the Hudson on a stretch of Lake Erie. He'd rode into the Ohio River, down the Mississippi, out into the Gulf of Mexico, and back up the Atlantic seaboard. Stone has written a book about his trip. It is titled On the Water, Discovering America in a Rowboat. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you're invited to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. Join the discussion with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, our number 333-9455. Anywhere else, call us toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, tell us about the boat you rode on this adventure.
Well, there was a first boat and then a second boat, and the first boat, neither one of which, to my lasting regret, did I build. The first boat was about an 18-foot, I would say a hybrid. If you imagine a kind of a mixture between a seagoing kayak and a recreational rowing shell rather than a sort of sleek racing shell. That was the first boat, in, made out of Kevlar. And it had a sliding seat with a pair of sculling oars, about 9.5 feet each oar. And the entire boat with its sliding seat weighed about 70 pounds. And I could not sleep in this boat. I found a way that I could sort of fall back into a resting position on my back, lying on my gear, but only really for temporary, you know, naps, maybe pulling up in beneath the shade of a willow tree. The second boat, I made it to the Gulf of Mexico on the first boat. For the leg home, I bought a second boat, which is about the same length, in fact, a little bit shorter in length, and much more seaworthy for the coastal route, and on which I could sleep. And so I had a tent made for the boat, and I would drop an anchor and sleep in the boat, which I did probably, I guess, maybe about 150 nights. And, it took a little getting used to. The slightest breeze or the passing of a boat and the wake would sort of rock me back and forth. But it wasn't long before I learned to sleep in that boat very well. Eventually slept, as I thought, sort of like a baby in a bassinet.
Hmm. And did you? And did they row the same way? Did they feel similar?
They rowed. The first boat was faster. If it had been a race, the first boat would have won. Sort of in a short sprint. The second boat, though, I think because of its momentum, once I got in shape to row that boat, I think it actually rowed about the same speed, which was about 4 to 5 miles per hour. And but ultimately, particularly for that coastal route, where sometimes, you know, the wind and waves would pick up, the second boat really was not only rowed more steadily, but was more of a home. Just more room in it. I could stand up at any point. I could make a little nest in the bow and take a little nap if, you know, found some shade and it was hot in the afternoon.
You write early in the book that this trip that you made is not an exotic adventure beyond the range of the average water or wilderness enthusiast. I guess I'm below average wilderness enthusiast. I'm wondering, you know, what level of physical and mental fitness does rowing a good 20, 30 miles a day require?
I think it's one of those things that if you have the time for it, I think it's similar to a bicycle. If you have the time for it on a long trip, in a way you can just simply, once you have your gear, you can just get in that boat and start rowing, as long as you're content to make maybe a couple miles on the first day, or maybe 5 miles. And, if you're not in a rush to get anywhere, before you know it, say it might be 10 days or 2 weeks down the road, you will be in the whatever shape you need to be to row, say, 30 miles a day. And that's pretty much what I did. I did a little bit of training starting 3 months before I set out. I got onto a rowing machine. 1 month before, so 2 months into that, and 1 month before I left, in a rock throwing contest with my brother, trying to hit a mooring buoy in a harbor, just sort of, you know, brother to brother competition, I threw my shoulder out. And so for the last month before I left, I really did nothing physically. And that was the evidence to me that really, particularly on, as I said, on a long trip, it's if you've got the time to sort of build in the training regimen as part of those first 2 weeks, that's really all you need. It's a very low impact. It's not like, you know, I mean, I think I probably would put more stress on my knees in running 5 miles than I ever did in rowing 500 miles.
Mm. Yeah. Well, somebody you met along the way, a member of an elite rowing group, told you, you know, that you keep on like this, you'll look like Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Look like Schwarzenegger, which was no compliment.
Right. That's you don't want to be stressing everything.
It's all about, as I learned, and I really didn't know much about sculling before I left, but I learned it's all about leverage and efficiency of leverage. And I think anybody who's even tried to lever some huge, heavy object with a, you know, 4x4-inch beam will learn or has learned about sort of efficiency and leverage. And that's what it's about with rowing, using the leverage of the oars, the leverage of one's body. And in fact, if anything, ultimately, particularly after that lesson, I lost weight on the trip and lost bulk.
Let's talk with the listeners waiting to talk with us on the toll-free line in Mansfield. Good afternoon.
Yes.
Hi.
I just finished reading a book about a month ago of a fellow that canoed down the Mississippi, and it seems like he mentioned crossing paths with you.
Oh.
Are you familiar with that?
Well, I wonder, gosh, if I knew his name.
I've been trying to think of his name, and I gave the book to someone else. Anyway, one of his concerns had to do with the river traffic, the barges.
Yeah.
And he made it sound like it was very dangerous and not something for someone else to try. What was your feeling in a rowboat?
People had certainly warned me about the barges, and so I heeded those warnings, and I sometimes wondered whether this is something I should avoid. Once I got on the rivers, and really the first barges I saw were on the, I guess, the Allegheny River, and those were small. And then I got onto the Ohio River, and they turned into about 15 barge towboats. And then the Mississippi, then you get into the 35, you know,
right,
and sometimes much larger towboats. But I came to think of these boats as steamrollers, and in which case I had lots of time to see them coming, whether they were coming from behind me or coming from the opposite direction, as long as I saw them. And if I didn't see them, like a steamroller, it would really be the last thing I ever saw. But really, they come so slowly that you really would have to be distracted for a long time, in my experience, to have any trouble with them. There were a couple times, I can remember one in particular coming down toward New Orleans, where in a bend, sort of the Mississippi sometimes has as much as 180-degree bends.
Mm-hmm.
And so all that water flowing around can be sort of chaotic. And I remember one time when I was thinking to myself, I really need to not stop rowing. I need to not have any gear break, and I need to not flip in the water right now. Because if any one of those things happens, I might get pulled into the course of this barge that is approaching me. But that, as it turned out, was not a close call, and I never did have any close calls. In fact, the barges were, I kind of welcomed their presence. On one hand, I was fascinated by the solitude of the lower Mississippi River. And at the same time, I had a VHF radio. I could talk to the captains. I would, if I saw a barge coming, I would call them up on the radio and say, you probably don't see me, but I see you. I'm about a mile off your starboard bow, and I'll be out of your way. And this would lead to, you know, 5 or 10 minute conversation, sort of a social call. You know, if someone were asking about going down the rivers with regard to the barges, I would say definitely beware, take a radio, and don't let it be an obstacle to the idea of a trip.
Another question having to do with his book, he describes a life along the river based on his interest in bars, I think. Not barges, but bars. And he made it sound like a very seedy-sounding community. But I wondered if that was just because he sought that out, or is it something anyone would...
I'm thinking now to the towns that I stopped and visited on the Mississippi River, which were Memphis and not very many. In fact, there aren't very many towns that are directly on the river. There are many smaller towns set behind the levees, but really from the point of view of paddling down the river, they might as well be half a world away. Memphis, Natchez, Vicksburg. I think if you go into bars anywhere, you're going to find, you know, what might be a rougher and tougher crowd. I between the Tobo Captains, which is, you know, we've got a big mining story taking place in this country, and some pretty tough, mainly men, working in those mines. And I think that those Tobo, it's a sort of a similar world, and yet I never met by radio or in person any but the most pleasant, interesting people on those boats, whether by radio or by handshake. And the same thing in Memphis and Natchez and Vicksburg. I just met the nicest people. I think it's a question of what you look for.
And he came down from Minnesota, and some of that was upper part above St. Louis. So
yeah.
Might have been different. Anyway, thank you very much.
Oh, pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions, comments are invited. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, call 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free. If it would be a long-distance telephone call for you, call toll-free. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455. On the Afternoon Magazine today, we're talking about the adventures Nathaniel Stone had as he rode his way around the eastern United States. He's written a book about his trip on the water, Discovering America in a Rowboat. It's published by Broadway Books. My name is Celeste Quinn. I want to pick up on that caller this afternoon and the question about, you know, the people that you meet and the people that you met on this trip. One of the most affirming things about this trip had to have been the way people welcomed you and offered you a hand and offered you a meal. Maybe you'd tell us the story of one of your first stops, where you were in Rhinecliff, Rhinebeck, and that's still in New York, right?
That's still in New York.
Yeah, and you met Alan and Michelle, their children, and Michelle's mother.
Marcina. Oh, it was just, this was a day I kind of remember, this was, again, it's, I think for me this was a trip that was a reminder of if you're happy to be in a place, you will be welcomed in that place. If you're happy to be there and it shows, it sounds like a children's song. And I remember that feeling in Rhinecliff on a sort of late morning and wandering into this very quaint little town with old brick buildings and clapboard buildings and had all the time in the world and I was looking for a phone, a payphone, and I saw a guy who was seemed to be at a very leisurely pace painting the trim on a building. And I asked him for a phone, and he said, oh, I've got my artist studio right here. You're welcome to use my phone, which I did. And that led to, once I returned outside, to a conversation with him. And he turned out to be a former college rower himself, and just, you know, a guy who was so, as I remember, just so present. He was in no rush to do anything, was happy to be painting, as it turned out, a cafe that he owned. And which all this led to an invitation to come home because he thought his two children would be interested in the trip. And so that's exactly what happened. I spent the night at his house and his wife's house with Stella and Isaac. And that night I thought I was with the four of them in the house, this big old Victorian house with roosters cackling early in the morning, crowing early in the morning. And that morning, the next morning, I was sitting with Michelle, Alan's wife, having tea, and all of a sudden the kitchen door opens and in walks another person I hadn't met before. It turned out to be this incredible-looking, probably in her late 70s woman with this craze of black hair and dark Middle Eastern features, and she was very, very light, very frail, stepping very gently and carefully, like a much older person might do, and she said good morning to her daughter, and immediately I heard this accent. Speaking of accents, I heard this South African accent. It was one of these sort of connections. Immediately got goosebumps, and I'd lived in South Africa, and all of a sudden, here's this unexpected person in the kitchen who has a South African accent, and I could hardly contain myself. And, you know, finally said, "You know, you must be from South Africa," and of course, she said that she was, and so, and this led to my telling her of my experiences in South Africa, and her telling me of her much more interesting experiences there, having washed the feet of Gandhi. Her mother was one of the early, very early opponents of apartheid, and it's just fascinating. Sort of one of those moments, the sort of lasting moment in this kitchen, in which I was thinking to myself, how did everything in my life lead to this? What moment could I take away from my personal history, and I wouldn't, as a result, find myself here? Why am I not in another house? Why am I even on this trip? But it was just a wonderful serendipitous moment in which I felt very much in the present.
Mm. Happy in a happy place.
Yeah. Yeah. And I suspect that, you know, I mean, I suspect at some level I or anyone could be in anybody's kitchen and have some sort of connection. Again, if you're not in a rush and if people have time for people, there's always a connection.
Mm. It's interesting to me. I sense that at the beginning of the trip, there was a little anxiousness. You have to pay attention to the tide and the weather and that kind of thing. But then very soon, a sense of calm wraps itself around you, or you are calm and able to breathe and able to take your time.
Yeah, it the trip certainly did have a calming presence, a calming effect on me, and I remember many times. I mean, many times when, say, all of my, you know, I'm wearing, it's now sweaty, I'm wearing my last set of clean clothes, and I'm down to kind of the dregs of one last gallon jug of water, and I'm almost out of food, or maybe I'm out of food, and it looks like it's going to rain, and I'm not sure where I'm going to pitch my tent. And in other circumstances, those equivalents might just have the most deadening effect on your enthusiasm, whatever is the routine of one's life. But the trip, something about being on that trip, about having such simple needs, none of that ever mattered to me. There was never a day, and this was for the first time in my life, there was never a day that I thought, I can't wait for Friday, or I can't wait this week, or, you know, the way I always did before this trip, and I sometimes now do again, sort of looking ahead. Anything that was coming my way was fine. Wherever I was great. And my needs were so simple that I could meet just one of them, and a large percentage of my needs would be taken care of. I got my 3 or 4 or 2 milk jugs filled with water, all set on water again. If I got a bag of apples, or I got a new, you know, little tub of peanut butter and a box of saltines, which I could get from the nearest, you know, gas station in many cases, I was, you know, all of a sudden things were sort of turning around. And if it rained, well, that's great, because it's going to have a cooling effect after a hot day.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of the weather, I've got to bring folks up to date on our weather situation here this afternoon on the 29th of July, 2002. We have a flood watch in effect for some portions of for a portion of our severe weather coverage area. The National Weather Service has issued a flood watch for Ford, Iroquois, and Livingston counties in central Illinois until 3 o'clock this afternoon. Also, the Storm Prediction Center has issued a severe thunderstorm watch for portions of southeastern Illinois and central and southern Indiana Effective this Monday afternoon until 6 o'clock, hail to 2 inches in diameter, thunderstorm wind gusts to 70 miles per hour, and dangerous lightning are possible in these areas. In the immediate AM 580 severe weather coverage area, the severe thunderstorm watch includes Clark County in Illinois and these counties in Indiana, Fountain, Park, Vermilion, Vigo, and Warren. That's a severe thunderstorm watch until 6 o'clock for Clark County in Illinois and Fountain, Park, Vermilion, Vigo, and Warren counties in Indiana. And a flood watch is in effect for Ford, Iroquois, and Livingston counties in central Illinois until 3 o'clock this afternoon. What was the worst weather that you faced on this trip?
I was thinking, gosh, if I were rowing through what you just predicted, it would certainly be another whole chapter. the worst weather always turned out, at the time itself, and taken in hindsight, to be the best weather. I've always loved storms. And one of my gripes about living in New Mexico is that I can get 60 or 70 or 80 straight days with hardly a cloud in the sky. But worst weather, I would say there was a storm. It was actually predicted to be a severe thunderstorm, and I had no way of knowing if it turned out to be severe, but it plowed right over me on the intercoastal waterway along the Georgia coast. And that was actually the one day on the second leg of the trip when I actually dropped the anchor during the day and put up the tent with really nowhere to go, surrounded by salt marshes, and just rowed out this storm, sort of like a, you know, with a boat at anchor, a little bit like a weather vane, and lightning, thunder and lightning cracking and flashing around me. But the first leg of the trip took place during the summer of 99, which was drought for much of the summer. And between Chautauqua Lake in western New York, which is the headwater of the Mississippi drainage basin, and the Gulf of Mexico, I can remember it raining a total of 3 times. And so I actually had very, very good weather from a precipitation point of view. And on the way back home, it was really, that one storm down in Georgia sort of stands out, but some of the best photographs I have of clouds were taken right after that storm.
Mm. Really, we're very fortunate in that way.
Well, it was also, the trip was broken up by the fact that I ran out of money. And so it was taken in 2 legs.
Mm-hmm.
I had hoped to, naively, as usual with money and me, I'd hoped to get back in the water in about 6 weeks, which turned into 6 months by the time I got a credit card paid off and saved up. I figured once I have $500 in my ATM account and 0 balance on 1 credit card and all the gear that I need, then I'm ready to go. And that 6 months took place when hurricane season takes place down in the Gulf. So I was able to avoid the hurricane season.
Hmm. What's the health of the waterways you traveled?
Every water, not speaking about the intercoastal and the actual open ocean, about which I heard almost nothing and could really observe nothing, but starting with the Hudson River and followed by the Erie Canal, Lake Erie, Chautauqua Lake, the Allegheny River, the Ohio, and the lower Mississippi, every one of those bodies of water was said to be much cleaner now than any one of them was, say, 15 or 20 years ago. I remember I'd always thought of the Great Lakes as being these polluted lakes, and no doubt there's still quite a bit of pollution, but the fact was, at least when I rode across a bit of Lake Erie, even at the waterfront at Buffalo, I could look down 20, 25 feet to the bottom. In fact, I met a guy who in Georgia, who had grown up in Buffalo, and we got to talking about the route. As it turned out, he hadn't been back since about 1982, and I just happened to say, oh, yeah, I came by Lake Erie, and wow, that lake is so clear. And he said, what? I said, oh, you can see down 20, 25 feet. They're finding wrecks that, you know, they're finding wrecks they hadn't been able to find for years. And he said, with all due respect, I can't believe that until I see it myself. When he was growing up there, he wouldn't even go swimming in the lake. So I'm not saying that there's no longer pollution, and of course there's a lot of invisible pollutants. But from environmentalists to those in the business world along these rivers, I was told, with really no exception, that they're much cleaner. I met by chance the mayor of Wellsburg, Ohio, a small town in West Virginia. And 1974, and it was nothing while on practice on the river to see kind of the rainbow of a little bit of an oil slick and untreated human waste. And I never saw any of that, maybe the slightest bit of gasoline at a marina, but really nothing to nothing unusual. So that was that sort of aspect of the trip was very positive, unexpected.
Hmm. Well, wasn't it in the 70s that portions or a portion of Lake Erie caught on fire?
I always forget what actually did catch on fire. Maybe it was more than one waterway. I thought there was a river near somewhere in Gary, Indiana, or it may have been Lake Erie as well. And not that there aren't still major and very well documented problems, a major one being, as many people have read about recently, the EPA and General Electric, which had been dumping, I forget now, over 1 million pounds of PCBs into the Hudson River over a period of 30 or 40 years. And that's a lasting problem, the way nuclear waste is a lasting problem. But then again, there are now fish species which had been banned as far as eating goes, which are now back on the, once a month now you can eat a certain type of fish, whereas before, for 20 or 30 years, once that problem had been identified, they were banned altogether.
Mm. I've been corrected. It wasn't Lake Erie. It was Cuyahoga.
I think that's right.
The Cuyahoga River. Somebody on the staff here who grew up in Cleveland passed that word on to me, so thanks for that clarification and correction. So it's now been a while since you finished the trip, almost 2 years. Does the voyage continue to affect you?
The voyage has defined really every aspect of my life since it came to an end. And it was a trip, and I use the word trip in a it's a shortcut, and by the end of it, it really wasn't a trip. It really had become, this is the way I lived my life, and which came to an end because I ran out of money once again. And the winter season was closing in on me. But it has, in the form of a book, has continued to live on, and certainly writing a book about this trip was not only sort of revisiting the trip, but also reinventing the trip. And it has lived on in continuing connections with those that I've met, often care of this new, to me, wonderful invention of email. It was just about a week ago, actually, in Maine, that I visited with a couple that I met in Louisiana who have been vacationing for a week in Maine ever since we met each other, and having told them myself how great Maine is. And here in Pittsburgh today, I've just arrived to Pittsburgh today, where I will visit with one of the rowing clubs here. And so the trip does live on, and it also lives on in that it was the first time that I ever did precisely, in the most selfish way, I did precisely what I wanted to do. And it was the happiest year of my life, year more or less of my life. And so in that sense, it's sort of it was finally a lesson at the age of 30, in my early 30s, to really pursue that which is closest to your heart. Mm-hmm. My older brother used to ask me, when I was wrapped up in something in which I was having a hard time, maybe work or something else, he would ask me, is that what you really want to do? And of course, I would say defensively, of course that's what I want to do. That's why I'm doing it. But deeper down, I knew that there was something missing here. This is the first time with this trip that I ever did exactly what I wanted, and I think that can have, I'm hoping it can have sort of altruistic byproducts.
Mm.
And I'm I'm grateful for the opportunity to have written a book as a way of kind of sharing this experience for those who are interested in boats and rivers and paddling and also in modern-day American culture.
Hmm. Well, it's a terrific book, and it's a great read, and I find myself now looking for Joseph Garland's book, and I also want to read the Hubbard's book. Now, what's the title of that one?
Shanty Boat.
Shanty Boat.
Shanty Boat. That, Joe Garland wrote the book on Howard Blackburn. And without that book, without the Atlas, I might never have taken this trip. And his book, Joe Garland's book, is Lone Voyager, and Howard Blackburn is really an incredible guy. His voyage around the eastern U.S. in a sailboat is really the least interesting thing that he ever did, and that was pretty interesting to me. And Shantyboat, written by the Hubbards about their houseboat trip down the Ohio and Mississippi rivers in the late 1940s and early 50s, is the kind of book that I think will make anyone who has any affinity for boats and for drifting and especially for rivers, it will make any person want to drop everything they're doing and sell the car and sell the boat. Go build a houseboat and truly have an adventure.
Well, I look forward to reading those books, and I have a new fondness for my Atlas, I'll tell you that. Nathaniel Stone, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
On the Water, Discovering America in a Rowboat. The author, Nathaniel Stone, he has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. The book is published by Broadway Books.